Welcome to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Ukraine, front and center. Are we witnessing regime decay in Kyiv? Is Zelensky now more afraid of the West than the Russians? And 6 months in, Trump's foreign policy is in tatters. Why has it gone wrong so badly? To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest. In Istanbul, we have Tariq Sarıl-Amar. He is a historian and a political commentator. And here in Moscow, we cross to Dmitry Babich. He is deputy foreign editor at Komsomol Skaya Pravda Daily. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's start out with Tariq. Events are moving very, very quickly in Ukraine, and the focus is not on the battlefield as it has been over the last almost 3 years, but now it's being focused on what's going on in Kyiv itself. The headlines over the last few days that Zelensky had backed the reform, quote-unquote reform of the anti-corruption agencies, which basically neutered them. We have to remind our viewers that these same agencies came into being under the Biden administration when we had when we saw regime change going on in, that was during the Obama administration, but it was under the tutelage of Joe Biden when he was vice president. These agencies are under attack. There's been a very, very strong reaction to it, negative. And as I said in my introduction, I think sometimes that the Kyiv regime may be more afraid of its Western backers now than they are of the Russians. Give us your thoughts, because this is on the back of the attack on the Orthodox Church, the lack of opposition parties, a mono information sphere under control of the regime. This is just adding layers to layers. Obviously, in Western media, they suddenly wake up to these things, but it's been a trend that we've all been watching since 2014, not 2022. Tariq.
Yes, that's absolutely right. It's a long-term trend. And if we are speaking about Zelensky personally himself, right, who won his landslide election on false promises in 2019, he started this process, I would say, in 2020. At the very latest, by 2021, you actually had a large-scale discussion about this in the Ukrainian public sphere. And a lot of the people who then later glorified Zelensky or helped glorify him in 2022, in 2021, they criticized him harshly for building an authoritarian system. You can go back and find all the evidence for this, right? All of this was nipped in the bud because in 2022, the war then escalated and everybody basically circled the wagons. But the short version is Zelensky has been building an authoritarian regime for about 5 years already. That the West is waking up to this right now, that tells you something about the West, not about what's actually happening in Ukraine. The other thing I would say is, and there are so many things to consider here, but one reason why Zelensky chose to strike at these two anti-corruption agencies right now is that they were getting very close to him himself, because they were about to go, in particular, after a man called Timo Mindich. Viewers won't know about him, but in Ukraine, he's known as something called a kashelok, a purse of Zelensky. And there are allegations that he's not only somebody who helped Zelensky hide ill-begotten wealth, but that actually in Timur Mindich's apartment, a private apartment, a lot of real politics, real policy decisions of the Zelensky regime were made, in particular, all the ones that are clearly illegal. There are also rumors that this has been wiretapped by the same anti-corruption agencies and that they were about to go after all of this. In fact, with Mindich, they've already started. Mindich is already fleeing. He is now outside Ukraine and hiding. This is a primary Zelensky friend, a big one, and they're after him. So what is happening is that Zelensky feels mortally threatened by these agencies, and behind him, he rightly sees the West. He rightly sees the West behind these agencies. So there's a possibility that Zelensky perceives all of this as an attempt to replace him. The question is, for what purpose? To then end the war or to continue the war under different management? I would like to add one last point. I don't want to take too much time. But there's something that's very different with corruption under Zelensky. a lot of people are now saying, oh, how disappointing. Zelensky is as bad as everybody before him in Ukraine. That's not true. Zelensky is much worse.
Much worse.
The reason is precisely the war and the money that's come in from the West. Zelensky has been operating at a totally different scale because the West has pumped him up with money. And the other thing is, of course, that when you're at war, corruption literally kills people. And one of the things that make Ukrainians so angry is that specifically a lot of these corruption cases are about the defense industry. They're about building, for instance, fortifications and embezzling the money instead of actually doing it. And when something like this happens, as Ukrainians rightly point out, people literally have to die for it on the battlefield. So what Zelensky is doing in terms of corruption is worse, and I'm including Yanukovych here, is worse than any Ukrainian leader before.
And Dima, as we all know, the U.S. And its allies backing Zelensky have turned a blind eye to this. I mean, remember when appropriations were being passed in Congress and a few intrepid individuals said, well, maybe we should throw an audit in on this too. Oh, no, you can't audit these people. No, because Dima, as corrupt as the regime is, and it's far more worse, as Tadika says, because it's scaled. I mean, we're talking, you know, tens of billions of dollars. And a lot of that is a kickback. It goes right back to the West, primarily to the Americans, because they're the ones that are putting the most money into it. So it's a mortal threat to the regime, and it's a mortal threat to the entire Ukraine project. And I forgot to add one more thing. Zelensky is no longer legally president of Ukraine. We throw it over to you, Dima. Go ahead.
I agree with Tarik that Zelensky is much worse than the predecessors, but I would develop on this. Until the so-called revolution of Maidan, until 2014, Ukraine was a democracy. There was corruption, but you could discuss foreign policy. You know, some people preferred Russian orientation, others preferred American orientation or European, doesn't matter. After Maidan, there was no discussion on foreign policy, no discussion on defense. Just the field of discussion narrowed itself to the question, who stole more, Poroshenko or Zelensky or the group of people behind them? And what happened now is that this so-called National Anti-Corruption Bureau of Ukraine, I have no sympathy for it. It was created on the suggestion of International Monetary Fund, and it was basically an organ that enabled the Democratic Party of the United States to control Zelensky and other Ukrainian officials. Anyone who dissented who could be declared corrupt in a matter of days. But sometimes these organs find basically unmask the people whom they are not supposed to unmask. You know, the National Anti-Corruption Bureau of Ukraine went after Vice Premier Chernyshov, who was a friend of Zelensky. And Chernyshov first refused to return from Austria, where he was on mission. Then Zelensky supported him, and Chernyshov returned. And there was a big scandal. And basically what happened is that it's like with the Nord Stream, you know, the German investigators found out it was not Russians who did it, simply because German investigators did not care about politics. They were asked to find out who blew up the pipeline. And they basically pointed all the pointers to Poland, Ukraine, and partially even to other Western countries besides Poland in the West. So basically what we see here is a conflict of groups inside this pro-Western coalition. But still, I don't think the West will dump Zelensky because he is useful, you know. There is no way back for him. He stole too much. There are tens of billions that were spent on Ukraine. Not 350 billion, as Mr. Trump is saying. I don't know where he took that figure, but a lot. And for Zelensky, it's now life or death issue.
Well, also, I think another thing we can throw into it is that things are not going well on the battlefield. That has been widely reported, though not admitted by legacy media. It's remarkable how legacy media in the West continues to say, well, you know, just a little bit longer and a few more missiles and a few more euros and dollars and they'll turn the corner. Mm-hmm. It's amazing that they continue to talk that way. But I think crushing these anti-corruption organizations there's a timeline in a lot of in the elite's mind right now. It's tie up loose ends, move things around, because they're preparing for the end game. I'm not saying it's going to be tomorrow or next month or, you know, in December or so, whatever. But I think there is that mindset that this thing is going to have to be wrapped up and they're going to have to start divvying up the spoils.
I think that's true. I also agree that we don't know when, and they don't know when probably, but the situation on the battlefield is definitely terrible. I mean, the most blatant example is Pokrovsk, major city, major strategic point, but it's not only Pokrovsk. It's all over the map, actually. Russian forces are advancing, and they're advancing on major settlements as well. That's one thing. The other thing is that even inside Ukraine, people are beginning to talk about the fact that the war of attrition is now grinding down Ukraine to the point that it soon will not have soldiers. There is a man who's currently in the military. His name is Ihor Lutsenko, not to be confused with Yuri Lutsenko. He used to be a deputy in the Ukrainian parliament, and he has come out, I think, with a Telegram post essentially saying, with his own calculations, he has access to statistics, and he's saying, in 2 years on current trends, there's nobody left. Nobody left to draft. Nobody left to fight. So there are all these things in play. And I think one thing that they're preparing is what is Zelensky and his team, people like Yermak, Chernyshov, Mindich, what are they going to live off? And of course, they want to live very, very well if and when they go into exile. So that's one problem they have to solve. The other thing is that if the war continues, and this time the Europeans pump in the billions, right? This is the new scheme. Then, of course, if you neuter these anti-corruption agencies, you have an even freer hand to do whatever you want to do with this money. But here's one important nuance I want to bring in. I think we haven't mentioned it yet. Zelensky has lost this round. And that is a terrible defeat on him because he had to actually backtrack on this. And they had to backtrack. We don't know exactly why, but it seems Western pressure played a role here. And I think that has done him great damage and shown Ukrainians that Zelensky is not unbeatable. You can get
well. We have to point out is that legislation that was signed in the middle of the night. Why it was so, such a urgent thing to sign, and then he, as Tadeusz has pointed out, he has backtracked and are proposing new legislation. But there's no timeline on that. Okay, so he's technically lost it, but it's still in place.
You can
gentlemen, I'm going to jump in. I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Remind you, we're discussing some real news. Before we finish with this topic of this regime decay in Kiev, I want Dima to finish it up here. Go ahead.
Well, a lot of Western media pointed out that this was the first demonstration, public demonstration of protest in Ukraine since the beginning of the war in 2022. What does it show
us? Well, Dima, can you focus in on that? Because I've seen a lot of demonstrations against the appropriation of the church and whatnot. I again, you know, the Western media suddenly wakes up, you know. As Tariq said, you know, before 2022, it was common knowledge. Ukraine is one of the most corrupt countries in the world, okay? So when Western media said these are the first demonstrations, I think we need to be give some more clarity to it. Go ahead.
The demonstrations in support of the church are dangerous. You can be beaten. You can be arrested if you take part. These demonstrations were completely safe because they were supported by the so-called Western NGOs. And, you know, my friends, Ukrainian journalists, looked at the faces of the people and they said, these are mostly the employees of these NGOs, their relatives who are afraid that
USAID money well spent. USAID money well spent. Go ahead, Dima.
and they felt themselves completely secure. Yeah. If a similar demonstration was held, you know, against real problems such as forced mobilization in Ukraine, when people, you can watch it on the videos, how people are pushed into minibuses and basically transported to the front line against their will. If there was such a demonstration, Zelensky would just shoot them all, and the West would not say a word. And with NGOs, you can't touch them. You know, they are the saints. They are the missionaries. They are the best people.
And they know English, Dima. Remarkable how many of those signs were in English. I wonder who their audience is. Other Ukrainians? Tariq.
Yeah, I think Dima is right about this. These are very specific types of demonstrations. And I believe that those who have talked about another sort of massive revolution sweeping away the Zelensky regime from below now have been exaggerating massively. For one reason, because it's only partially authentic at best, and to a large extent it's inauthentic because it's associated with inauthentic institutions that serve the West to a large extent. But the other thing is the demonstrations weren't even large enough to pose a real threat. What I wonder about, this is my only thought about this, I wonder about whether it might set an example where maybe other people will learn from these demonstrations by maybe misunderstanding them, that you can now go out and have demonstrations. And then scenarios might develop that are closer to what Dima has mentioned, where really hot topics are attacked in demonstrations and protests, such as forced mobilization. And then who knows what would happen? That's what I wonder about.
Okay, I want to switch gears here. Dima, I want to talk about Trump's foreign policy half a year in. How do you think the official Russian position is looking at Donald Trump? He was supposed to end the war in Ukraine in a day. Oh, before he was even inaugurated. And then it was by Easter. And then it will always be a couple of weeks. Now we have 50 days. Does anybody in the Kremlin take him seriously anymore?
Well,
officially they have to, because he does have real power. But
exactly. Exactly. There are basically the official position is that we welcome President Trump's peace initiatives. He did a lot, and you can hear it from the official spokespeople. But the realist view, the scientific view, if you want, I think it was best summarized by my friend Boris Mizhuev, a political scientist in Russia, who said that Trump is just another project of the deep state. I don't like this expression deep state. I prefer a radical ideology. You know, it's just like the 1917 revolution in Russia. There was no Jewish conspiracy, but there was Bolshevist ideology. You know, it's a fact. It's not a conspiracy theory. The same thing in the United States. I don't believe in deep state, but I believe in a radical ideology that stems and has been stemming the policy of the United States. And I think what happened was that at a certain moment, the elite decided that Americans were carrying too much of a burden. So it was time for someone like Trump, who was not afraid of being politically incorrect, just to cut some expenses, you know, to stop migration, to impose tariffs on China and other countries, just to ease the burden on Americans by rude means. You know, the problem is that Trump is just unprofessional. You know, he antagonizes people without need, simply because he's uneducated. You know, when he says that it was the United States who won the World War II, how many people, are insulted in Russia? You know, we lost 27 million defeating Nazis. So basically, and then people ask, where does this terrible Russian nationalism come from? Well, it comes from statements like this, you know, when someone like Trump says that it was his nation that won the war. But basically, what happened was that we see how this theory of Trump, peace through strength, how it is crumbling. Because basically, in this, Trump is united with that radical ideology. What does peace through strength mean? It means total dominance of the United States and their allies, something like the Roman Empire in the beginning of the Christian era. Yeah. And we know from experience, we know from history, peace is not achieved through dominance or through common disarmament. Disarmament would be nice, but unfortunately, it's a utopia. Peace is realistically achieved by dissuasion, by balance of forces, when you have two or several big players who are afraid to go to war against each other because the consequences may be unpredictable. We're trying to rebuild dissuasion. This is the real cause for our action in Ukraine.
Well, we've gone back to where what we're seeing is great power politics is basically the history of the global system. I mean, it's great power politics. It doesn't mean it's going to be any safer. That's what I argue with the realists. You know, Dima is right. American foreign policy is ideologically driven, but if you, a realist one can be different, but it doesn't necessarily make it any better because, you know, Tariq, we still have, you know, we have a new administration relatively still, but we still have the Gaza genocide, Yemen, Iran, Ukraine, Russia, the BRICS. I could go on and on. How is that any different than Biden?
Well, that's, of course, a big question some people are asking. And some are giving a very clear answer by now and saying it's not different, especially after this turn against Russia, right? I think they have an extremely strong case by now. I would say it's also not over yet. That's the one caveat I would have, that we do, I think, also all agree that Trump has a very unpredictable side to him and that he's changeable. So we don't quite know what the future will bring, but on, you know, current evidence on what we have seen up until now, there is now an enormous continuity with the aggressive policy of the Biden administration, unfortunately. If I may add one point to Dima's point about winning the Second World War, I would reinforce that, actually, because on one side, there are the terrible sacrifices and the terrible cost that the war imposes on the Soviet Union, the 27 million, the destroyed country, and so on. But on the other side, it's also a fact to win the Second World War, the one power you definitely had to defeat, the worst of the Axis, was, of course, Nazi Germany. And the Soviet Union, clearly, every normal historian admits this, West and East, the Soviet Union made by far the biggest contribution to destroying the German army. You can count different ways, but you look at least at 80% of the German land forces were actually taken out by Soviet forces, right? There was no other way of winning this. This is very important to know as well, I think, when Trump talk such nonsense about World War II. I would perhaps add one thing, one skeptical remark. Look, the most cynical answer to your question, or the question of this program, if Trump's foreign policy is falling apart, would be, and it's not my answer, but hypothetically, it would be, no, it's not falling apart because he's always been lying. Maybe the real foreign policy has always been the foreign policy of essentially lying to everybody, trying to lie to the Russian leadership, which didn't go for it. And when that didn't work out, just switching back into open confrontation. I'm not quite with that argument yet.
I see where you're going, and it's hard to disagree with that. But to bolster your position, is that Trump has just embraced the deep state, and it's a mutual embrace.
Yeah,
I think in many ways. Yeah, because he knows what they could what would happen to him if he said first. But why fight him? Join him, Dima. Go ahead.
I think let's call it the deep state. They just decided to cut expenses, you know, and suddenly they were unmasked, you know, because Trump is doing exactly
I'm sorry, Dima. I don't see the cut in expenses. The defense appropriation is like $1 trillion right now. Okay, USAID, it's gone, but the same funding will go to different programs for the same purposes through the State Department. I think it's more switch and bait. I don't see any saving of any money here. Go ahead.
I meant the other kind of expenses. You know, the money that goes to the defense industry, the money that goes to multinationals, this is their money. You know, the deep state loves it. This is their purse. You know, what they don't like is, you know, when the United States had to give preferential tariffs to allies in Europe, in Southeast Asia, because there was competition with the Soviet Union. So they decided to cut on these expenses. And they did it in a very indecent way. You know, someone like Biden or Obama with their political correctness couldn't do it. So they found a guy who was not afraid of mainstream press, who already has a bad image, and who can just talk bluntly, you know, like, I'm going to take all the money to the United States. And that pleases the audience.
But the logic of this, Teddy, after the Second World War, the United States gave preferential treatment to Europe so we could rebuild. Okay. But part of the deal is we control your foreign policy. And so that was the quid pro quo. And the Europeans were quite happy with it. And now they're saying you have to follow us, but we're going to make you pay for it. No, they're breaking the deal. Tariq, before we finish up, go ahead.
Yeah, but Peter, you could even argue very cynically that by breaking the deal, they're succeeding. Because after all, they got away with that. They essentially turned to the Europeans and said, you will obey us as never before. And on exactly. top of it, you will pay yourself now. And it worked because the Europeans actually went along. So in that sense, if that's the policy, there's a piece that worked actually. I think if I may add one final point, I think with some people, including me, there was a hope for a while that Trump and people around him especially might be ready to radically rethink America's place in the world. And they might go away from the idea of primacy and reconfigure America's position as, yes, we are a great power, we are second to none, but we accept that there are a few others around us, right? We don't want to dominate everybody. And I think what we are seeing now, the policy we are seeing now or for now, is again primacy. We want to dominate everything.
Well, I don't know. So what's better, primacy or hegemony? I'm not really sure. Maybe we're splitting hairs here right now. But I absolutely agree with both of you. The more things change, the more they don't seem to change. Gentlemen, that's all the time we have. We went very quickly today. I want to thank my guests in Istanbul and here in Moscow. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.